Hello, and welcome back to the Research VR podcast. I am your host, Oz Balabanian, and with me today is, again, Peter Lekhoff.
Hello, everyone.
And as our special guest, joining us is Elizabeth Lee, VP of SciArc.
Hey, everyone.
Hi, Liz. How's it going?
It's going great. We've got, always have a lot going on at SciArc, and it's fun to be meeting in VR, which is an area we spend a lot of time in these days.
That's right. I think a lot of our guests are always like, this probably is one of their first or early, one of the earlier times that they've actually met and done meetings and stuff in VR. And it is for us as well. Like, we don't sit in a VR room having conversations every day, but it's definitely showing us the future. Today, I guess we should probably start from the beginning. Liz and I met at a education conference, or I wouldn't even say call it a conference. It was a school up in Marin County in California where they were showing off how VR is impacting education. And SciArc was one of the people that were demoing there. And we got to get to know each other a little bit, and I got really interested in what SciArc's, you know, mission plan was. So I guess, Liz, if you can tell us a little bit more about what you guys do.
Yeah, so it was fun to meet at that event. You know, we've been doing a little bit more in education, but SciArc, it kind of the 1,000-foot level is a nonprofit organization. We're headquartered in Oakland, California, and our mission is to capture, archive, and share the world's cultural heritage. So, for those that aren't familiar with what cultural heritage is, it's you know, the sites and monuments left from previous generations, everything from archaeological sites like Pompeii to the more monumental like the pyramids of Giza or Chichen Itza or Mount Rushmore here at home.
Wow. You guys scanned and captured Mount Rushmore?
Yeah. So we use a variety of reality capture technologies to go and record these sites, so that we can aid conservators who and site managers who care for the sites today. And then we also archive that data so that it's available for future generations. So in the event of any kind of disaster on site or destruction, that we have data within our archive that can be used to help rebuild or provide a record of the site for the future. And then we're getting now with all the increased capability of VR technology, we're bringing the data within our archive to life in whole new ways. So letting people virtually visit these places in a much more engaging and immersive medium.
That's awesome.
What's your background? So how did you get interested in such a, well, very exciting, but also like historically fascinating topic?
Yeah, so my personal background is actually in archaeology.
Nice.
So yeah. I studied archaeology, but was always kind of fascinated in the way that we document and record the work that we do. So, you know, I would be on site in places like Hungary and Turkey doing excavation of really early settlement sites, and you know, daily you're discovering all these kind of amazing pieces about human history. And so part of the challenge is, how do you make that information, how do you record what you're finding, and then how do you make it accessible to people in a way that they can really connect with history? And that's how I found my way to SciArc. You know, I'd done photography and things like that before, but SciArc was a whole new level of being able to very accurately record the built environment, and offered huge potential for making that information accessible to a broader audience.
And why is it so important to do that?
Well, you know, I think for on the accessibility side, you know, you think about, some of us are probably fortunate enough to have had the opportunity to visit some of these places, but a lot of people never get that opportunity. And I think when you do get to travel, you know, even if it's just travel for just purely kind of enjoyment, you have the opportunity to connect with people of other cultures, and it can really promote a much broader understanding of our shared pasts. And so what we're hoping to do by recording these places and making them more accessible is to not only show this rich history that we share as the human race, but to also, you know, better connect people to the world around them.
Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, I think you hit it, you hit the nail on the head when it comes to, it's a multi-pronged approach to the reason why you'd want to capture these places. Like one would be to visit, but the other is, and I think the more important one is the record that you get to keep. And even if the places, I'm guessing, that aren't destroyed, like even I'm sure places like Mount Rushmore are in constant flux of like things happening to them, right? They change over time.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're capturing it at a specific point in time, which you can roll back to.
Yeah, you know, we you know, some of the sites, you know, we documented because there's active conservation happening at the site. So, you know, Mount Rushmore, you don't think of that changing. You know, it's carved into stone. But the reality there is that the National Park Service really wanted to monitor the site better. That the sculptures actually contains a number of these different what they call rock blocks. So there's different veins running through the site, and those individual blocks are actually moving and shifting with the natural kind of freeze thaw cycles of the mountain that you get in the Black Hills there. And so being able to have a really accurate three-dimensional record gives the park that baseline information to then monitor any of those changes and be able to make decisions off of that. But then we have other, you know, other sites. We've done a lot of work in Southeast Asia in the last year, and kind of team just got back from doing work at the old capital of Ayutthaya in Thailand. And that's a site that they've had a lot of flooding at recently. And so the monuments are, you know, they have an issue with settlement. And so being able to provide a record, a point in time record to say, you know, this is the angle of these giant chetties and their position today. And then, you know, with any potential future flood events, we can use the data within our archive to compare the flood, you know, the monuments and what might have happened due to either the flooding or any kind of settlement events that might occur after.
I wanted to before we jump more into SIAR, because I think there's so much that we can start kind of like picking at and uncovering. Let's go back to archaeology for a second in terms of talking about when you were studying. I mean, what were the current methods that were very commonly used? And I think some of what you guys are doing now started from archaeology. I think that archaeology was probably the force that pushed a lot of these technologies to get developed. So yeah, if you can kind of talk about that change.
Yeah, so you know the. Archaeology and kind of historic preservation more generally is usually not a field that gets to take advantage of the latest technology, right? You've got, it's a more traditional field with less resources. So, you know, most of these sites are recorded just through kind of simple photography, or even in some cases, it's just hand sketches and notes. So what you're doing is, you know, recording the current state of the monuments, either through, you know, drawings, or photography. But you're limited in what that information can capture. So, you know, archaeology itself is inherently three-dimensional because you're removing information. You know, early on, there was an interest of how you can get better and more accurate recording. Because once you excavate something, you're changing that site. And so what the technology, what this like 3D laser scanning and photogrammetry now allows for is to create that point in time record so that you can see the site, you know, maybe before excavation starts. And then, you know, some archaeological sites now have the advantage of having access to some of this technology, and they'll go and they'll do a recording at the beginning of each field season and at the end to actually be able to show the excavation and the progress that they've made.
And I think it's also not a coincidence that the Realities.io co-founder Dave is also an archaeologist himself, right?
Yeah.
So something that must really trigger your deep motivation and your interest when you're working with something that changes over time, that ages or just getting destroyed, and you can actually capture in 3D, right?
Yes, yeah, look exactly. At it again.
Were some of these methods some things that you're using when you're studying, or have they developed after? And that's, I guess, is that how you found yourself in SciArc?
Yeah. So, you know, the excavations I worked on were more photographic based. So I did, you know, a couple different field seasons. The first work I did was in Hungary at a Neolithic settlement. So right before, you know, right as people are starting to settle down, learning to farm, learning to domesticate animals. And that was a fairly, you know, lower tech site. We did some photography on site, but a lot of the sort of daily records were based off of sketching. And doing just note taking in the field. I then worked at a site in Turkey, also a Neolithic site, a site called Çatalhöyük, which is kind of one of the earliest, largest human settlements, with you know, Stanford and Berkeley. And you want me to spell it?
Yeah, I'd love to see it. I'm so fascinated. C
A T A L H O U. Hoyuk.
Cool. Let's see what this looks like.
And
wow. Yeah.
So pretty cool site. Big excavation team from Stanford and Berkeley and a number of other kind of European schools. And so in this case, they really are very active in the recording that they did. So you know, photography all the time. And they've actually even started to, you know, beyond just the kind of photographic record, use kind of traditional survey. So total station. And then I think actually after my time there, they've since actually gone and done some 3D laser scanning and probably photogrammetry as well. So as the, you know, the having been, you know, using a number of these technologies for quite some time, you know, as the cost has come down of technologies like laser scanning, and as the software has improved for things like photogrammetry, they've become much more accessible to, you know, kind of the research field, especially in the humanities, that don't always get access to these types of tools because of the high cost.
And what kind of technology do you use in your everyday scanning? So do you just rely on laser scanning, or is it more photogrammetry, or do you kind of use mobile lidar systems?
So SciArc, SciArc was started in 2003, and when we first got started, the primary technology we used was terrestrial based lidar. So we were actually founded at laser scanning.
And how, but, you know, if you can describe, I guess, even the process of doing something like that. Are you walking around with a handheld laser scanner, or those stationary?
Tripod based. So we were actually founded, SciArc was founded by one of the original developers of the early laser scanning systems. So that were tripod based, designed to be used from the ground. So, you know, we use that technology where, for those that aren't familiar, the scanner sits on a tripod, and it sends out a pulsed laser beam, measuring the whatever it can see. So the early technology that we used was originally a time of flight based technology. So the scanner itself measures how long it takes that laser beam to leave the scanner, hit an object, and return. And using that time of flight measurement along with the angles, it could calculate a 3D point in space. And so, you know, the early machines were capturing a few thousand points a second. Now the machines that we're using capture millions of points a second. So what it does is it basically scans the surface, whatever it can see in a 360 degree view. It depends on the device. So usually, you know, the team we have on site today, they're using a machine that can go up to about 300 meters.
From one point.
Yeah. So 300 meters in a 360 degree field of view. But then because of, it can't see through, the object. So then because of all the occlusions that are formed, you then move the tripod around the site.
Yeah. Shadows to fill in.
You know, Exactly. Right. So we may do a few hundred scans on a single project.
But you could technically even film a cave with it, right? So even something that is like super big, large, but also has a ceiling wouldn't be a problem.
Yes, exactly.
As a quick aside, how are then the different points of scanning combined into a single 3D object? Is that precisely measured by, or do you have like control points that you basically have to mark that are the same between the scans?
So the software works in a few different ways. So let's say on a project, you know, we maybe have 100 different scan positions, and it's moving around, you know, a number of buildings or monuments or even through something like a cave. In the same principles, if some of your listeners are familiar with photogrammetry, where you take overlapping images. So the scanning systems work in much the same way. You need common points between the different scans, and those are both a combination of shared points on maybe your area of interest, like the monument. So doing overlapping scans where one facade is featured in both scans, but then we can also use external targets as well that are stationary on another tripod, or even could be a paper target on the building itself. So fixed points that don't move during the scans. And then the software, what the software does, it will use those either external targets, or a lot of the registration now can even, depending on the monuments that we're scanning, can even be done by just the recognition of those common points within the scans. So the software has gotten quite a bit better at, you know, you bring in all of the scans, and it can actually recognize those common points, sometimes automatically. Mm. And especially when we're using, you know, the devices can capture the LiDAR data, the laser scan, you know, point cloud data, but they can also take photographs. So it can use, the machines can use, and the software can use those photographs, can use the GPS information within the scanner, and then the common points to be able to fairly accurately position those individual scans and then merge them together into a single point cloud.
That's it's very detailed.
It's very impressive, right?
In terms of the photograph that it's taking, is that used at all to get colorized textures for? Because I know from what I understand with LiDAR is that you get really accurate geometry. However, it's doesn't can retain like the color information that is reflected.
Yeah. Correct. So for our method, the scanners, a lot of the scanners now have onboard cameras. Mm. You know, that will take basically a spherical image from the exact same location as the scan is happening. So you have a panoramic image, you know, maybe 100 megabyte kind of panoramic image, and then that can be used to color those individual data points. For our purposes, we do the coloring and the texturing from external photographs, because it gives us the resolution that we are trying to achieve. But for some applications, you know, most of the scanning is used in civil structural applications, construction projects. A lot of times they're actually just relying on the color that they can get from the scanner and not, you know, mapping external images, because the color from the scanner is sufficient for their purposes.
Right.
Do you use radar?
We don't use radar. We're doing our three primary technologies that we use are the LiDAR or laser scanning data. We do photogrammetry from the ground, so terrestrial photogrammetry, taking lots and lots of overlapping images. And then we also use drone imagery, aerial imagery, to map inaccessible portions of the site, as well as provide the contextual and landscape information.
Yeah, we had actually one episode about Azad's drone experience and how he was using the photos to do photogrammetry, right? So you do it in a similar way, and you just let the drone fly around and you later take the photos out of the video footage, or?
Well,
no, so we actually just use, I mean, we will shoot videos with the drone, but the drones are used to capture images. Right. So we'll do a number of kind of grid pattern flights to capture the photographs that we need. And then, you know, with sort of certain objects, we'll also do circular flights around points of interest. but all capturing kind of single images that are taken at an interval that allows us to bring them together.
Right. And plus with the images, you'd get way more resolution than you would from, say, like a 4K still from a video. But that was something I was messing with, that after I had been to these locations and I'd also shot like stills and videos there. And then I realized like, oh, I could still use the videos to cover up holes that I had forgotten to take, you know, images of. So that ended up being really useful. And that's like something I do at the end of all scans. And I was like, I walk around either with my camera or any kind of a camera with a video, just like everything.
Yeah. Helps.
So that, I mean, obviously this is incredibly fascinating. I think another point about Sirik that we probably didn't talk about in the beginning is that it is a nonprofit. I don't know if you mentioned it. So with these projects, who ends up funding them, and like how do they come about, and how can people, you know, if they know of historic sites, like what's the process of it going up on your list and as you're going through it?
Yeah, so we are a nonprofit organization, which means that, you know, we need to raise funds to support the work that we do. And the funding comes from a variety of sources. So, you know, we do get individual donations from people that care about history and appreciate the work that we're doing. So we actually get a number of small donations throughout the year. And then we have some other individual donors that will contribute larger amounts and maybe sponsor a specific project. And then we work with a lot of corporations and foundations as well. You know, we identify areas of interest for those companies that are maybe operating within a certain geography and want to sponsor a project, say in Asia or Canada. And then we work with the cultural contacts within those countries to identify areas of need. So we do a lot of work now with UNESCO, which is the United Nations Educational, Cultural, and Scientific Organization. And they have these sort of regional offices where they can identify the sites where there's a need for this type of documentation that maybe can help in an active conservation project. Or, you know, we've been doing a lot of work in the Middle East over the last year where, you know, the monuments are really at risk there, and have worked through kind of local offices to partner with professionals in country where we maybe can't physically send our team. So we've done a lot of trainings, right? Very, very dangerous. So we've had a team that's been working in Syria, but we conducted all the trainings in neighboring Lebanon, in coordination with the UNESCO office in Beirut. So we've been able to have a great team on the ground there in Damascus, capturing data and actually sending it back to our office.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
For processing. Yeah,
that's my hometown. History destroyed. Really?
It rings true to me. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Beirut, and
great.
My parents worked a lot with a lot of social workers, and Armenians had their own kind of like organizations that would help, with their own communities. But like, yeah, I think I really understand kind of like the vision and the passion that's driving you guys to these places, because especially in Syria, I used to visit Aleppo a lot of just growing up.
Yeah.
And the history that you know, the thousands of years of different cities and civilizations that have kind of been in that region is kind of incredible.
It's such a rich area culturally.
What have you guys captured in Syria? I'd be very curious to know.
So the work to start has been around the historic center of Damascus. That's where we were able to get to professionals that could carry out some of the work. So, you know, the team has worked some on the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus, as well as a number of the kind of individual monuments. The Al-Azam Palace is another one. Kind of big structures that are within that historic core of the city. All the training work on that project has happened out of Beirut, because we've been able to bring people out of Damascus. get trained in a more stable area, and then they've been able to go back in and do a lot of this capture work.
Wow, that's awesome. I'm sure people, the listeners also are like just oozing with excitement. So I guess
coming back,
go for it, Peter.
Maybe coming back to the topic of VR, like, do you see a higher spike in interest in your work after the new VR wave started to come and people could actually put on a cheap Oculus and just basically visit the places themselves?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that's been so exciting about this evolution, so we've been around since 2003, kind of gathering all this information, and that we really haven't had a good medium for sharing it. We do a lot through our website, so you can go to psyrc.org, and we've got, you know, virtual tours up there and 3D models. But it's fairly limiting as a means of really showcasing the data that we've collected. And so, you know, about a year ago, as VR technology has kind of become a lot more accessible and available, we started experimenting with bringing content within our archive into VR. And that, it's been an incredible experience to just see, you know, be able to walk around sites that we've captured, you know, projects that I haven't personally been on that I've gotten to really see up close for the first time is just incredible. We've got a project that we did earlier in the year at Mesa Verde National Park. And, you know, we had it here in the office and I got to walk through this site. And then later in the year, I had the opportunity to actually physically go to that site in person. And, I already knew it in and out because of the data that we had captured and the level of realism, because it's all based on this reality capture data, you know, we're not doing, you know, the hand modeling of these sites. We really have the sites in their real geometry and the real color and texture.
Right.
So it's incredibly realistic and really immersive experience.
And have you ever tried to actually don't only do still images, but some kind of volumetric video? So maybe it's an example. The company I'm working for has a research project where we try to capture medical operation center. So when doctors actually try to do a surgery, we kind of want to capture that in 3D using volumetric video, and then for the nurses later to kind of walk around and see where they could support the doctor. I'm not sure how much volumetric video would help in archiving still mountains, but maybe some kind of old culture, some kind of old place or tribes doing some kind of rituals that might not exist in 100 years. That's something.
Yeah, interesting thought. You know, what we've started to pull in more and more is actually the audio recording. So, you know, our work focuses on the built environment and what we call like the tangible cultural heritage. But so much of that, you know, that experience is the sounds on site, as well as the people that work there, right? The archaeologists, the historians, really the experts on these places. So we've begun to record their story as well. So we capture ambient audio of what the place sounds like, but then we're also doing audio interviews so that you can walk around one of these sites and actually hear from one of the, you know, the park rangers or the archaeologists who knows it better than anyone.
That's really cool. With these audio recordings, are you guys, you know, using any kind of like ambisonic recordings, or how are you trying to capture the ambient sound?
So we're still experimenting there. You know, we've got a couple of different you know, a surround recording devices, and then, you know, the interviews are more just a traditional kind of lab mic. But I think as we kind of bring this stuff into VR and you know, examine the types of experiences that we can create, I think that the audio recording process for us will get more sophisticated.
Do you have a strong do you experience that the technology that you're using got better because of self-driving cars using the same lidar systems, of VR relying more on audio? Do you like the tools that you have been using for a long time like suddenly getting a huge spike?
Yes. So the not only the technology to be able to capture more quickly and accurately. So, you know, LiDAR systems have come down in cost. The drone systems, you know, the accessibility of that technology is really incredible. But the biggest spike, I think, for us is really on the processing side. So, you know, there's new software now that for the first time allows us to combine the LiDAR data with the photogrammetric data to really take advantages of the strengths of both of those technologies. And that's been a huge step forward, because the, you know, a highly realistic 3D textured model that we need for VR is also incredibly useful for the conservation, you know, the architects and archaeologists that are working on these sites. So from that 3D model, we can bring that model into to VR and walk around and experience it. But we can also then, you know, slice that model in a traditional kind of a CAD program. So bring it into AutoCAD and plot drawings of these sites, sections, elevations, the kind of traditional outputs, but they're all scaled and, you know, photo real, which is a huge advantage. Especially we've been working on this one project at the site of Bagan, where they've got these incredible Buddhist murals. And so being able to replicate those at the full scale and color accuracy is very, very useful for those working on site trying to figure out how to best preserve that information.
So over the, 15 years that SIARC has been around then, if it's from 2013, I guess, where did that start from? And I guess, were you there in the beginning where this was happening and what was like driving the force behind something like SIARC to be created? Also, can we talk about the name a little bit in terms of?
Yeah. So when SIARC was started by a guy named Ben Kassira, who was considered one of the founders of 3D laser scanning. And he's originally from Iraq. Actually, he was immigrated to the US and was an engineer. Did the startup thing, you know, helped develop some of this technology that was actually eventually acquired by Leica Geosystems, one of the manufacturers of the scanning systems today. And right about the time that he sold his LiDAR company was when the Buddha structures in Afghanistan, the Bamiyan Buddhas, were destroyed by the Taliban. And so he was so struck by that event, having developed this technology that could be used to very accurately and quickly record the built environment, and then seeing, you know, this destruction of history. So him and his wife decided to start SIARC as a project of their family foundation. It was really, you know, in the early days was kind of an R&D project. Of, you know, how can this new technology, it was very new at the time, be applied to cultural heritage? It was already being used in engineering and construction applications. And so a lot of effort spent, you know, how do you record historic sites and monuments in a way that's useful? And how do you start building the relationships and the methods to do that? And so I joined the organization in 2007. And, you know, since then, you know, we've since kind of spun off out of their family foundation. We became an independent organization in 2008. And we've done work on over 200 sites around the world. With the beginnings of the organization, it was really about creating that archival record. How do we capture this information and store it so that it's available in the future? And that's still a really core portion of our mission, so that, you know, we have the record of these places if anything happens. But, you know, with the development of VR technology and really being able to see how that data can be used today, and the improvement of software to work with this information from a conservation standpoint, really kind of completes the cycle of our mission. So, you know, we can go out and capture this information for the archive, but we can also provide value to people that are working to preserve the sites today. And we can make that information available for really anyone that wants to learn about these sites and experience them. So the mission is really, I think, more important than ever. And we're, because of the advancements of these various technologies, we can kind of really fulfill those other parts of the mission now.
I think the fact that it's very future oriented is pretty unique in that sense, where there, you know, everyone's built that's building a product these days is just like, okay, these are our needs now. These are our problems. This is exactly how we're solving towards it. And there's very few people and organizations that are like doing all this work now that, like, yes, you know, it's relevant and it can be used by scholars that are relevant in that topic.
Sustainable. They never think about sustainability.
But their true value will really come in, let's say, a couple of decades when you're like, whoa, like let's roll back time a little bit and look at these sites. In terms of time,
that's actually one of the challenges right now is that, you know, even as amazing as it is to walk around these sites in VR, you know, the resolution is still quite low. You know, the amount of the polygons and textures that you can bring into VR is quite limiting relative to what we're capturing. And so, you know, within the last year, we've spent a lot of time of how we can make sure that we are still capturing to a standard that will, you know, be relevant into the future.
Right.
Yeah. Even if we have to decimate and process that information down to be able to view it today, making sure that we have that information for the future.
But the great thing is that the tech for this, the processing, this is only going to get better. And so if you keep all the raw images and all the raw scans, I'm sure we're going to be able to get better results even in the future of the scans that are done today.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's really exciting to me. I think
it is.
Oh man.
Just such a great usage of this technology. So I don't know, goodwill driven. You know, it's not the next startup, just really awesome things that can benefit the history and can teach people the history and like can very bring them tangible new realities. Yeah.
Yeah. And in the most virtual way, like the tangibility of things. I guess the question that comes to mind is, especially when it comes to capturing, you know, you capture a environment at a space and time. Are there certain places that really almost like ask or call to be like captured multiple points throughout time so that, because it's just changing quickly or like how do you approach something like that? And if you have any examples?
So I think, you know, moving forward, you know, provided there's the funding and the support, you know, it would be very interesting to look at some of the sites that are maybe more dynamic. What we have had though is several instances where, you know, we've captured data and then an event happens. And then that data is actually used to kind of inform the process moving forward. So the site I mentioned, this Begone project, we first went to the site in 2016. And then about 9 months after we had been there, they had a major, or less than 9 months, I'm sorry, it was about 3 months, they had a major earthquake. So temples that we had recorded, you know, were damaged in the earthquake. And so we've since gone back and we actually have the data now to be able to compare the before and after. So for people, the architects and conservators, you know, it's really, really helpful for them to have that record, to know what was there before, and then to actually be able to see the change that's happening now.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Do you have any kind of a quick way of like switching back and like if you overlay the two spaces on top of each other, is there a way to switch back and forth and kind of like?
We haven't done it in VR, but we have in other, you know, 3D modeling programs, just be able to compare the two dimensional models. And you can see, you know, the top spire is missing and there's other parts of the facade that have come off. And it's a real kind of stark contrast.
This is, I think another question that comes to mind is, you said in terms of the availability of this data, what goes through your guys's kind of decision process or, you know, when, if someone is requesting, access to the data, like how do you kind of prioritize, that process?
So the idea, from the beginning was that CIRC would be this open access archive. And one of the challenges with that though, is just the, you know, serving that type of data. And so right now we have a pretty manual offline system where people can request the data for non-commercial use. And
that's just commercial use? Can it be used for a movie?
No, not non-commercial. So for research, okay. For education. And but we're hoping to actually build out a you know, some kind of way of actually making this a bit more automated. It's quite a challenge right now for us that, you know, mm-hmm. these data sets are quite large. We can't afford to just host them, which right. would be the easiest yeah. way to share it. Mailing hard drives back and forth is kind of cost prohibitive.
Oh, man.
Yeah. for a nonprofit. So we don't actually have, you know, the intent is there for us to share it. But you know, it's been very limited over the years just because sure. of the hurdle of sharing this. But I think what we're going to start to see in the next, we're hopeful in the next 6 months or so that we might be able to start making some of these sets available. And we're looking for the right partnerships to help us do that.
Awesome. Nice. I mean, in an ideal case scenario without any of the constraints of data transfer and whatnot, like who would you ideally want to be using this? And you know what, you know, who would excite you if they came up to you? They're like, this is awesome. This is what we want to do with it. Where do you see that?
Yeah, well, I think the data within our archive holds a tremendous promise for education, and for research. So, you know, anyone that wanted to be able to, you know, we have a lot of teachers that access our content, bring it into their classroom. That's really exciting, right? You know, you're providing access and the event that we met at, right, is all about bringing this into schools. We've done events locally, bringing VR headsets into schools in Oakland and, you know, sharing really far-flung places with kids that are never going to get a chance to go there. And so I think those types of applications are really exciting, right? Opening up just the access to this. But also the research side of things, right? You know, you think about the number of people that maybe study, you know, the Roman Empire, and yeah. and what if you could really democratize access to a large number of sites from a research perspective? What new things might we learn about the history there? So I think that's also very exciting, and so I think, you know, research and education would be probably the first areas that we'd want to promote use, and then we can see where it goes from there.
Totally.
Wonderful.
Yeah, this is, I'm thinking of which direction we can take this into. I guess let's talk a little bit about, you're mentioning before we start the podcast, where you've deployed a few teams around the world. I guess, so yeah, what projects are in progress currently?
Yep. So we, I mentioned, you know, we've been wrapping up work on what we've got right now. We've got a team in the field in Canada at a site in Toronto. It's the largest collection of buildings from the War of 1812. It's kind of in the center of the city. It's a really kind of interesting contrast between these historic buildings and kind of a military fort, and then the modern city of Toronto in the background. Mm-hmm. So they're wrapping up there today as we speak, and then up next we've got a couple other projects that are really exciting. So one is that we're going to be sending a team to Armenia to do a couple of sites there. And we've been working in collaboration there with TUMO, and we'll be training some of the students there. And then later in the year, we're going to be, we just announced a collaboration with Air New Zealand. We're going to be doing work at the site of the Waitangi Treaty Grounds, which is really kind of the birthplace of modern New Zealand. So it's a Maori site where the signing of the treaty took place. So really kind of amazing, you know, Polynesian art. And so we'll be there in December.
That's awesome. We've got
some exciting work coming up.
And when you said New Zealand, I thought for a moment you were going to say you're capturing the Lord of the Rings environments for historical accuracy. But I think that would also be
I also had this thought.
that would be a
It's you could look up the site. It says they've got traditional waka, like a war canoe, and the meeting house where, you know, lots of Maori art. It's gonna be cool. And Air New Zealand is sponsoring that site, in order to try to raise awareness of some of the non Lord of the Rings history.
I'm sure that's a terrible stereotype for that country. You know, they just deal with that.
Yeah. Have you considered filling the scans with life? So after you scanned it, you kind of take the 3D environment and fill it with some kind of storytelling characters running around that you not only can view basically the rocks being there, but also how people carved them, or maybe how some tribes went there, or some animals. So basically fill in the living environment.
Yeah, we haven't done any of that. You know, it's one of the, I would say, one of the challenges of, you know, doing that well, and being respectful for the cultures, you know, that sort of created these places. So we really focus on the architecture and what's there today, but are trying to do a lot of that storytelling now through audio recording, and are just starting to experiment also with 360 video. Maybe at this site in New Zealand, we'll have a chance to record some of the ceremonies and some of the, you know, the Maori dances and the haka. If we have an opportunity to record that with 360 video, I think that could be a really cool experience to pair that with then the environment that you can walk around.
Right. You can go to the spot where the camera was and, you know, play the video, and you're exactly right where you would actually be.
That's what do you personally...
Actually, I was going to ask that question as well.
Thinking about VR?
Oh, no, I was going to ask, what would be your personal, like, historical place that you really want to go and capture, or, like, one place that you haven't been to yet?
On the bucket list, I feel like I had an answer for this.
Have you guys just been knocking out the ones that you really wanted to?
we're also going to be doing work in Easter Island later this year. I forgot that on the list, and that's a bucket list type of site.
Totally.
Petra is another site in Jordan, which is really fantastic, that I think would be a really wonderful experience to go visit, as well as the I love the Terracotta Warriors in China is another one for me, which would be pretty cool. So giving you a kind of a broad geography there.
Totally. Well, I mean, you're coming from a historical and archaeological, you know, background, so I'm sure you've thought about these places and studied these places in various different forms, but this is kind of the ultimate, it seems like this is kind of the ultimate form of, like, actually tying in all these different elements together to creating a truly realistic recreation for archives and for usage today. Like, what's is this, like, a really exciting and passionate place for you to be in your career? I mean, if you can tell us a little bit about
I think
that.
I think, you know, CyArk's a really special organization. We've got a really dedicated team. You know, people are you know, they're really skilled at what they do. You know, we've got some, you know, the great team that goes out and captures with a level of precision that's just unbelievable. And then we've got, you know, 3D artists and production people here in the office that really excel at bringing all this data together and creating these beautiful outputs. But behind all that is just the passion for the mission, right? And really being excited about the work that we're doing and connecting with people out in the field that, you know, the outputs that we can derive from the data that's collected can really make an impact in their daily work. And that's a really powerful thing to be a part of.
Totally.
But how many employees or how many?
We're small. We're about 10 people. So,
and you still manage to do such an awesome work with just 10 people?
We work pretty hard. That's the thing with a passionate organization. You get people that are just you know, putting a lot into it.
Totally.
So what do you think about the current emerging virtual mixed ambient spatial graphic computing virtual reality mixed next things?
Yeah, well, I'm personally really excited about it. I think, you know, it's still really early. I think that, you know, there, for us, it's been, you know, this kind of key to unlock some of the data within our archive. But I don't think we've really seen, I haven't personally seen, you know, this sort of killer experience that brings it all together.
But do you think it's coming?
I think it's coming. Yeah. I think as more people experiment within it, and there's a lot of interest and energy around it right now. I think it's a good community of people that share and collaborate. And so I think we're getting there. I think we'll start to see, new experiences come out that are really exciting and fit the medium well. And I think, you know, on the hardware side, you know, as that continues to improve, we'll just see a greater adoption than we're seeing now.
Do you get support from the VR community? Like, what?
We do have some partners within the VR space right now. You know, my hope is that will continue. There's more, certainly more to do to really kind of push the field forward.
Definitely is. How can people find out a little bit more about SciArc?
So I would encourage people to go to the website, so sciarc.org, but we're also on, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And if you want to kind of know the latest, I would recommend checking out the social platforms. We're trying to do a lot more to actually share our methods as well. So we're, you know, posting 360 videos around some of the equipment we're using in the field. We've got, you know, photographs and videos of the field team out there, and then some processing shots too of the software that we use. So that's one of the best ways to kind of interact with us is follow along. And
Sci-Arc,
you know, we've got a new
CYARK.
CYARK, so like Cyber Arc.
That's right.
Is how the name was formed.
And how can people support the project?
Yeah, it seems like.
So there's we will always take a donation. So we've got the donate button on the Facebook page as well as on our website where people can contribute. But certainly just sharing the word as well, right? You know, follow us on the various channels. That's great for our sponsors as well. Showing that we have an audience and telling people about the work that we're doing. We're going to be launching more public experiences later this year. So that's the best way to find out about what's coming down the pipe.
Yeah. And how can people reach you?
Me personally. So you can connect with me on Twitter or you can email me at SciArc as well.
What's your Twitter handle?
It's I am Liz Lee.
@IamLizLee. There you go.
Yeah.
Easy enough.
Wonderful.
That's awesome. And you can follow us at ResearchVRcast on Twitter and at ResearchVRpodcast on Facebook. And Peter, if you want to throw your personal handle in there.
I have a personal handle that others are too afraid to pronounce, and I can't pronounce this neither. Just search for Peter Lekhoff or use the handle Raise Yellow or however you pronounce it in English. I don't know.
What's the story behind your tag? What is that?
Oh my gosh, it's from a game. It's called Legacy of Kain or Legacy of Legacy of something. It was a vampire who then became an angel who was thrown into holy water. And now
sounds fascinating. Search for Peter Lekhoff. Search for Elizabeth Lee, or type in I am Liz Lee, or you can find me at AzadUX on Twitter. So thank you again, Elizabeth, for being here. This has been a fascinating conversation, kind of talking about where we are with our history capture method and where we'll be in the future being able to roll back time. I think I'm really excited about that.
Well, thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun to speak with you both, and looking forward to seeing what else you guys cover on the podcast in the future.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Bye.